Hello, and welcome to episode 69 of Thacy Books. News and views about Thacy literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. In today's Thacy Craft Chat, we have Tanais discussing their new memoir, In Sensorium. In this conversation, we talked about creating new pathways to tell our individual stories and collective histories, honoring our literary lineage, dealing with being both invisible and hyper-visible, and much more. Tanais is the author of In Sensorium and the critically acclaimed novel Bright Lines, which was a finalist for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize, the Edmund White Debut Fiction Award, and the Brooklyn Eagles Literary Prize. They are the recipient of residencies at McDowell, Tin House, and Gerasi. An independent perfumer, their fragrance, beauty, and design studio, Tanais, is based in New York City. Follow them on Instagram at Studio Tanais. In Sensorium is a memoir from a writer and perfumer, but also offers a critical alternate history of South Asia from an American, Bangladeshi, Muslim femme perspective. From stories of their childhood in the South, Midwest, and New York, to transcendent experiences with lovers, psychedelics, and fragrances, to trips home to their motherland. Tanais builds a universe of memories and scent, a sensorium. Alongside their personal history, and at the very heart of this work, is an interrogation of the ancient violence of caste, rape culture, patriarchy, war, and the inherited ancestral trauma of being from a lush land constantly denuded, a land still threatened and disappearing because of colonization, capitalism, and climate change. Fragrance has long been used to mark who is civilized and who is barbaric, who is pure and who is polluted, who is free, and who is damned. Structured like a perfume moving from base to heart to head notes, In Sensorium interlaces eons of South Asian perfume history, erotic and religious texts, survivor testimonies, and material culture with memoir. It is archive and art, illuminating the great crises of our time with the language of liberation. On a personal note, this book took my breath away for many reasons. Structure, language, research, and history, and putting everything on the line. This is one way to take control of our own narratives and take our power back. Here's Tanais now. Welcome to Thacy Books, Tanais, and congratulations on the new book, In Sensorium. I just absolutely loved it, and I'm really looking forward to discussing it with you today.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to talking to you, Jenny.
Yeah, I know you're going through a whirlwind with your book promo and launch, so we'll try to keep this not too heavy. Let's start with, you know, I always ask this question because, you know, as a writer myself, it always fascinates me how people decide, how writers decide to commit to a particular book. And what was that moment of commitment when you decided this was the book you needed to write? And I know in your author's note, you know, you've mentioned how as a Bangladeshi Muslim raised in the US, you're writing because of your grandmothers. And, you know, so tell us a bit more about just the impetus for the book, please.
You know, it's interesting. The process of finding this book was something I had to fight for. I think as a fiction writer, first and foremost, I've always found fiction to be the freest way to communicate what I want to say as a writer. And that notion changed as I started writing in Sensorium. I think part of it was I had a novel that I was working on for a few years, but the feedback that I was getting from publishing was that they didn't see this as a book. They didn't see these characters as people they wanted to, you know, spend time with. And that was obviously for all of us who've dealt with any sort of rejection, it's really hard to come to terms with that. But I had a kernel of an idea for In Sensorium that I fleshed out into a proposal because I felt called to give historic shape to the stories that I want to tell as a fiction writer. And how can I soften the ground for me to lay these stories down in a way that actually resonate and actually make sense? I think that the publishing world is quite limited in how they see our stories. And this project has been a way to really proffer a history, my own embodiment, my experience as a Bangladeshi Muslim femme person, hopefully, you know, creating new pathways for telling our stories in other forms in literature.
Yeah, I know, you know, you've mentioned this. I've been following you on social media for some time now, and you've mentioned this about how our stories are received or not received or perceived, you know, by publishing. And that's a big theme for me as well, because how I see how our stories are even covered in the media, mm-hmm. even mm-hmm. if they manage to get published, you know. Mm-hmm. So what I was fascinated with in your book was, as I said at the beginning, I mean, that I was truly moved. The language is perfect. You're engaging all the senses, which is what this is about. And, you know, in my writing workshops, I teach about writing with 8 senses versus just the 5. And that takes a certain level of mastery because, you know, you evoke the sense of place, the sense of time, the sense of the unknown and the mysterious. And all of that is so great. But what I was also taken by was the amount of solid research that has gone into this, because you're telling us your own story. And yet there's, I mean, that bibliography, I already marked a bunch of books and articles that I want to go and reread. So tell us maybe, how did you organize all of this information to bring it forward? So that it was illuminating your personal story, but also making sure that you were bringing some of these critical, you know, bits of history, if you like, to the world, because so much is unknown, as you rightly pointed out. There is so, I don't know, people don't know much about Bangladesh's history, you know? And so I think that you've done such a great job in bringing some of this out. And so how did you organize all of that? How do you decide to, what needs to be brought in as you're telling your own story, which is, I'll get to your story in a second, but I just would like to hear more about that.
I just absolutely love that you're going into the bibliography and looking at the different texts that I used. I think there's several things that are sort of coming to me as I'm thinking about it. I think as a writer, especially with this work, I wanted to move intuitively and really give the reader that sense that I'm making associations that are coming from within that I want you to find resonance with. So it's connecting, you know, the history of indenture with the fact that, you know, the British were criminalizing sexualized brown feminine bodies in their project of colonialism. So there's like these narratives that I felt like really, you know, kind of give us a frame to understand the way that we walk in the world today. And we are drawing from the past, even if we don't know those pasts. You know, one of the things that I felt really called to as I was reading all these works is like, how I'll come across some sort of detail and there'll be a serendipitous moment where it fits into the work that I'm actually writing. And those became the notes that I was collecting to create these notes for my people. When we talk about, you know, the history of Bangladesh is not well known, it's like, well, who is it not well known to? You know, of course, some of the things that I talk about in the book, my father could, you know, tell you the details off the top of his head within a conversation that's 20 minutes, historical kind of facts, if you will, that I had to read about for months trying to find that information. When it comes to the story of people who are outside of the caste system, if we talk about South Asia, then yes, the facts become a lot murkier. And there is a sort of retelling and embodying those people's lives and their narratives in the work. And I really wanted to give the reader, especially to me, like speaking to American-born Bangladeshi femme people, if I get really specific, who are these, who are my people? I think that part of doing this work is showing that I am not the first of my kind. We are not the first of our kind. Our foremothers had a huge role to play in their thoughts and ideas in shaping South Asian history and also India's independence and liberation. And those narratives are lost to the dominant culture, patrimyth of Indian history. That doesn't mean it's lost to us. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's something I really felt called to do, because growing up here, so much of my identification was with the dominant idea of South Asian, which is Indian. And I talk about passing in my book and the discomfort I felt with that, but it also served to protect me when I was a young child growing up during the Gulf War. And, you know, my name that I was born with, Thonni Nandini Islam, this is a name where I can extricate Islam from my name and people would not even know my ancestry, my identity, the religion of my birth. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of things that I was trying to fit into larger milieus that, you know, I think show how we all belong to something much larger than our own individual experiences on earth.
Right. And you know, you mentioned just now about, you know, my people, and that's kind of the subtitle as well, Notes for My People. And I was thinking a lot about that as I was reading, you know, who is the audience for this book? And you know, you write in the book as well about invisibility. In fact, you talk about being both hyper-visible and invisible at the same time in America as a Bangladeshi, as a Muslim, as a femme. So this book is really a response, right, to all of those kinds of invisibilizations or the hyper-visibilization. So as I think about that, and I'm gonna get, we'll get into a little bit about the book itself, but as you step back, you know, your first book was this novel, which did very well. I mean, that's how I came to know about you. What do you hope this book will do or stand for? Who's that person you really hope it's going to reach?
I think that for me, I see this as a book that I would love to reach not only South Asian people in the diaspora or in, you know, our respective homelands, in Desh. I feel like I'd love for anyone who's really trying to understand how they can decolonize the way that they move through language, anyone who is thinking about liberation as a practice, as something that we do when we are creating our work and our art, it's for people who seek that. And I think that that is never going to be, you know, tied to any identity that mirrors my identity. I think my readers have shown themselves to be people who are dealing with their lineages and their bloodlines, and post-colonial legacies. And the, you know, thing that I do talk about in the book is just like being in diaspora, it's almost like you feel like you're a simulacrum of beige, like trying to reach for something inauthentically. And I'm not so interested in authenticity. I mean, I'm interested in syncretism and multitudes and how we are all kind of impure. And I think ideas of clean and pure and authentic and origin are what I call patrimyths, like dominant culture lies that protect the powerful. And they're very, very anti-liberation, anti-truth. I don't find that those lies offer comfort to people who are never perceived by them. And when I talk about being hyper-visible and unseen, you know, it's like I assert my embodiment. I have a fragrance and beauty company. So it is about being seen and smelled and held in the body that you're adorning with these things. Mm-hmm. But do you read about my work in dominant culture media, in the places where people are reviewing and writing and talking about works of art? No, you don't, actually. And that was the case for my first book too, with certain places where as authors, we want to be covered and be seen. I did not experience that in all of those places. And that's something that I don't even think we're really allowed to talk about or given space to talk about, because there's this idea of, well, you should be grateful and have gratitude for this space that you are given, which I do have. I would never not acknowledge all the people who have helped me, who read me, who hold me. But I cannot help but also call out the places that don't even act like I exist.
You know, and that was one of the things that I think back in the days when you were still on Twitter, I think that was one of the most, you know, one of the most refreshing things. I honestly, I started to follow you then because you were among the few who call these things out. This was even before, you know, I was just getting onto Twitter. I was just beginning to get onto social media. So I didn't even know. And I followed you for that very reason. So I think to your point, you've been calling this out and it's necessary. I completely agree with you. How we use words, you bring this out many times in the book, and you decode certain words, whether they're used by us South Asian Stacies or by, you know, perfume companies. I thought that was also very interesting. And I think patrimyth is probably, I think your book is the first place I read the word. So I don't know if you've coined it, but that's a great word.
I did coin it.
Yeah.
It's beyond the record.
Yeah, you should trademark it. I think it's perfect. It's perfect for what, you know, you described. And one thing, you know, you discussed the whole Desi versus South Asian. And I know it's a problematic thing, you know, South Asian being a colonial thing. And, you know, it's fraught in the US. Some people don't like the word Desi because it's seen as synonymous with Indian. And so I've had that conversation with some people. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, what I also find, to your point about how we are seen, how our art, the work that you do in with your business, and I'm going to come to that, I have a question there. But this need to either show only certain aspects or to romanticize certain things does reduce what we do to caricature or stereotype, right? Mm-hmm. And what I love that your book is doing is it's putting all those complexities together and saying, here's the good, here's the bad, here's the ugly. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, because there is, like you said, you know, the diaspora, so the Desi diaspora, there is still that need, you know, to feel authentic, like you say. And I always say to people, there isn't even an authentic South Asian person in South Asia, right? So there is no such thing. So let's not even talk about it in terms of authentic. So I'm totally with you. But can you talk a little bit about, you know, when you, the language itself, you know, some of these terms that you've decoded in the book,
And they were fascinating for me. I wanted to go and kind of get into rabbit holes there. But, you know, talk about patronymics. Talk about how you coined that. Mm. When did that first come to you, and just what these words?
So I think I just want to acknowledge that just the act of using language and speaking is grappling with power and grappling with a record. And there are experiences and feelings that exist beyond language. And when we try to put language to those experiences, it can be very painful. It can feel very disorienting. And that's something that I struggled with while writing the book, because I knew that using texts and records, that means the things that were actually documented. And that means there is erasure happening, even though I'm trying to talk about erasure. And it's like these little kind of ways that we try to keep our writing as true as possible, especially when you're writing nonfiction, where you have to hold the complexity and nuance and discomfort that arises in trying to be true. So the word patrimyth came to me because I was really in a Sanskrit dictionary, and by nature of how Sanskrit functioned, it's like you are using this written script and the language of power to talk about power and to talk about how people were erased or invisibilized. And I was thinking about the word patra as, you know, papers, documents, but also like patriarchy, father, you know, like just the masculine. And myth, as we know, like what myths are, you know, stories that are rooted in a telling that is maybe supernatural, surreal, but also mithya, lie. And I was thinking about the lies of our fathers, the lies of powerful men, as a way to erase all that has inspired their quest for knowledge, their quest for power, their quest for mythology. And that word, as some sort of kind of point in my journey, really allowed me to call things out as I was learning and writing this book. I think that that was really, really important for me. Some of the Bengali Muslim women writers who I talk about in the book, I mean, they're very known to people in Bangladesh, but I don't know if they're known to people in other parts of South Asia. Mm. I don't know if their, you know, work is seen as a part of the idea of India or the idea of Pakistan, but these femmes belong to those nation states. And then I get into how the nation state itself is fought for in the name of femme bodies who are annihilated for that actual, you know, liberation that is not for them. So I don't know. I think it was very, like I said, intuitively moving through history. This word sort of helped ground these different lies that I would come across while writing the book.
Yeah, I thought that language aspect was, I'm a translator myself, so I'm always decode some of those social and socioeconomic issues, sociopolitical issues. And sometimes, you know, we struggle, translators, we struggle because of the silences we know that are in that original text. And so how do we bring that across? Because it was written by, like you said, you know, it might have been written by an upper caste Brahmin male. Mm-hmm. And in my case, with, you know, translation, it tends, some of those works that I've done are written by upper caste Brahmin men. Mm-hmm. And then I think, how do I bring across what they have left out, you know? Yes, so I think it's interesting you get into that in the book, and I was fascinated. And then you talk about the literary foremothers. I loved that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, in 2017, I pitched a multi-part essay on my own literary foremothers, you know, but I never got around to finishing. I loved how also some of the section epigraphs that you have throughout the book They are from women writers of color, especially Desi women writers like Darfia Fezullah. So, and I thought that's important because our words are seldom quoted. Sometimes even essays that have been written by Desi writers will quote non-Desi writers, right? So I loved that you quoted, you know, our literary foremothers. So tell us a bit more, if you wouldn't mind, you know, what they mean to you. How do you see that lineage for yourself?
I think that we have to always remember that we come from a collective consciousness. And this very act of writing a book or, you know, making knowledge something that is tangible through words and language, there is an indebtedness that we have to the people who give us that very knowledge. And I wanted to do that through these small epigraphs that are kind of laced throughout the book. You know, the different metaphors I have for the shape of the book, I think everything is metaphors. Perfume for me is the central metaphor, but I was thinking about, you know, the beads and flowers of Amala, like a garland of stories that I'm beading together. I was thinking about one of the definitions of Tantra as a loom, a warp, a weaving. So I'm weaving together all these stories. It's like quilting, pastiche. These are all the metaphors that have also been some of the primary ways that women and femmes have told their stories without language, creating visual languages and heirlooms and artifacts. And in the several partitions that our peoples have experienced, these artifacts are what people carried on from generation to generation. Mm-hmm. And those are all subtly woven in. I think if you're South Asian, maybe you're really seeing and feeling that in a way that maybe you're not conscious of how it's playing out as you're reading, but I try to create like a system of various metaphors that are very rooted in femme and women's experiences. And I think going back to my grandmother who you brought up, my late grandmother who died at the beginning of the pandemic, you know, I never got to see her again, but I have her artifacts that she created. And she was very prolific in how she would sew gata quilts, shawls, you know, the different textiles that let her express not only her artistry, but I think a way for her to transmute her pain at losing her child and all that she sort of lost along the way. So I don't know. I think it's just like finding different ways of honoring knowledge that are not given that space when it comes to, you know, power.
Yeah, you know, I totally felt that that's what you were doing. You were creating a space to honor these literary foremothers, which doesn't happen often because, you know, they've been written out or neglected. They've been footnoted in the country. And I think, you know, doing that is so necessary. You know, we need to bring more of that out. You mentioned, just as you were responding there, about the structure of the book. And I thought, I noticed that, and I thought it was very clever. Obviously, you've got the base notes, the heart notes, and then the head notes. And with these three structures, did you always know that you were going to structure the book that way, or did that just evolve once you started writing?
It definitely started to evolve. And at first I was hesitant to even name it that way because I think like, you know, as a writer, I'm like, oh, people have a reaction to things that feel like a gimmick or an easy thing, right? So I was like, I don't know. But then I was like, you know what? Let me go head first into what I'm doing, which is like taking away that kind of judgment of things that are seen as too much, gauche, florid, floral, whatever. You know, it's like I make perfume. That's what that is. And that's where some of my most profound understanding of language comes from. And I need to just go into that. Where I started the book is with the heart notes. I started with my experience of sexual assault and talking about the liberation war and mass sexual assault and talking about my mother and my grandmother and my sisters. That's where I started. I started with the heart and I sort of radiated outward from that heart. So the way that I wrote the book and how I ended up kind of framing it were different processes, but I think owning the fact that the smelly, the femme, the florid, the wanton, the sexual, the unwanted, that's where I needed to go. And I feel like as we talk about erasures of femme and women writers throughout history, something that I've had to come to terms with in this first week of letting the book out is knowing that that also may be my story and finding peace with that. Because time scales are not media time scales or human time scales. Time scales are, once you create this work, it's there to be discovered forever.
Yeah. And I mean, to your point earlier that you said as well, there are things that in the book that, you know, people aren't going to pick up consciously in the first read, even though it may resonate for them. I know, for example, I've just read it once. I'm going to have to go back and reread because there were things that I was like, oh, I highlighted it and I want to go back. And because there are layers and you have to really sit with it and hold it within you to really understand it. And I think that's important because this is a complex book. I felt like as I was reading, even though what you've just said is it wasn't necessarily structured in the order that it is now, but even though that's the case, as I was reading, I felt like I wondered whether the writing of this book was also you coming into your own power even more. You know, I felt that putting it all down in a way, as I said before, all the good and the bad and things that, I mean, I'm not a memoirist. I find it hard to even write personal essays, to be honest. I hide behind fiction. For me, this reading this, how bold I thought this, you know, the inner journey that you must have had as you wrote the book.
Yes.
And I know you mentioned, you know, you had long COVID while you were writing.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're dealing with this physical thing going on where you lose your sense of smell, which is like the most important thing for you.
Yes. And then you're writing. That's the way I make money.
And then you're writing this book. I was like, oh my gosh. So can you, I mean, this takes so much courage to put it all on the line like this. So talk a little bit about that inner journey, perhaps, as you were writing the book.
You know, it's interesting. I definitely had to sort of confront that truth for me, which is fiction is always a safer ground to bury secrets. I say something like that in the book. And this was like, I'm scorching the earth to get to that place with nonfiction. And it's so scary, you know, but who is it scary for? You know, I am writing in a very privileged cocoon, no matter what illness I'd struggled with or what erasures I've felt I've had to deal with. I'm writing about people who perished and were killed in war, people who had to deal with, you know, living under colonial rule. And we are still dealing with war and imperialism to this day, but I am still afforded the space and privilege to write. So I felt very called to being as true as possible to the discomfort I felt and working through that, because there is a reclamation and a power that exists when you do that. And to be a South Asian person, a Desi person, a femme person, a Muslim person, asserting my sexuality, my pain, my, you know, fear, the way that I am navigating this world. If we look at the eons of writing and history that we are descended from, I'm not sure we've always seen the truths that kind of give the world reason to disregard us. You know, there's this need, I think, that we have all been raised with to show our worth and our value. Mm-hmm. And that is rooted in casteism. And that is what I keep going back to, is this division by the smelly, and the fragrant, the, you know, the good smells and the bad smells and the pure and the polluted, the powerful and the weak, all these constructs, these binaries, these systems are rooted in a very damaging and violent system of ordering the world. And we're descended from that. And I felt very called to annihilating all of those kind of limitations and showing the breadth of my imagination and my mind and my embodiment.
I thought you did a great job of, you know, just kind of setting things up and then dismantling them. I think it was great. I mean, what you just talked about, where you've written about it in the book, to the modern obsession with clean beauty and perfume and how it's code for colonialism and how it doesn't acknowledge, right, that someone has to get dirty to harvest all those flowers and turmeric and sugarcane. And that brings me to, you know, you run this business. I've been to the website, but I don't know the whole Genesis story, but I know you've been doing it for a few years. So you've got this, you know, beauty products, makeup and perfumery business. And as I think I've said to you, I find it amazing. I still remember that PRI episode where you talked about how you came up with a perfume for Toni Morrison's novel. I still remember that. I had to listen to it twice. It was so beautiful. So, but tell us a little bit about, you know, the journey as a business person and how you had to move through the world as you created this business that then culminated really in this book as well, you know, this perfume business.
So I've been doing this work from probably 2014. And my first novel, Bright Lines, came out in 2015. So the reason it kind of came to be is because I was laid off from a job at a sort of hipster startup company. And before that, I was a community organizer. I was a youth educator doing theater and writing and empowerment workshops for young women and femmes in New York City high schools. I've been a domestic violence counselor. There's so many different lives I've had that led me to perfume. And it's kind of, you know, one of those things where I'm like, I don't think the history of my life is necessarily something that I've ever given space to write about and talk about in this way, which of course I did in the book. But the reason I started perfuming after being laid off is I had taken a workshop with an independent perfumer, created some failed experiments in perfume, but then really started to get into the materials and the places that these materials come from and constructing these new, I guess, like sensory, I don't know, they were like olfactory art experiments. I wouldn't even say they were perfumes yet. But what I started to feel is that not only had I always had a nose for, you know, actual perfuming, I was thinking about how this actual product, I guess this perfume, this candle, this, you know, object that I'm creating can be a way for me to sustain a livelihood that keeps my writing separate and protected and gives me a sense of freedom when I write, because my writing is not my predominant form of having a livelihood. And that was sort of something that started to become very apparent to me as I started to see my products in different stores and kind of selling them online and finding their way to people. It was a way to reach people beyond language, but through aesthetics, which is it's been very important to me, because I think part of my project is finding a way to create things that help people, the people I'm adorning, the people who are wearing my things, to connect to something that they find very beautiful within themselves and the way that they express their beauty in the world. And for Black, Indigenous, brown skin, femme people to find that is so powerful.
Yeah.
And it's something beyond language. It's something that you can't necessarily find in a book. And I honor that through the work that I'm doing with beauty and fragrance. And this book obviously is trying to find the connection to language and writing.
Yeah, no, that you make a very good point. I mean, I was a teenager when I left India and went to the UK, you know, to study. And I, to your point, we repress so much of ourselves when we feel that the world isn't able to receive us the way we would like to be received.
And just judged for how you look, how you smell, how you walk, how you talk, you know, the colors you like. You know, I remember my mother would always try to make me wear mustard yellow. She's like, you look so beautiful in mustard yellow. And I was just like, I had a reverse reaction to it when I was 13, you know. Of course, now I'm obsessed with all the things she was obsessed with for me.
I mean, she loves that.
I was like, oh gosh. But I just remember like always wanting to find comfort and ease. And I think that's what dominance does. Dominance wants you to be a part of the majority, a part of the group.
Yeah, you need to be part of the apparatus, right? So that's why they need you to
and
be
when
part
you're
of the system.
A child, you're being broken into that, you know, which is so sad because children are so precious and their freedom. And we're slowly breaking that away from them and causing them a lot of harm, honestly. And I don't have children, right? So my products and creations and books are going to be my children on this planet. I mean, that's what I got, you know? Right. So,
I don't have children either, but you know, I totally hear you, and I see how there are others who do comply because they feel that's the way to get along. And it's sad to see those children being suppressed or, you know, repressed, but I want to talk about one more bold move that I thought you did in the book here, which was parts of the book are addressed to an unnamed man. You're writing in the second person.
Yes.
And I'm not going to ask you to name him or anything, but I talk to me about that choice to write in the second person. I'm curious about.
Oh my goodness. So I think that part of, you know, speaking into the silences and the hidden narratives of history and mythology is part of this vision that I had for Incensorium. And one of the ways that I really got into holding the breath of history and the breath of the damage of casteism and colonialism is through this relationship with the lover, you know? And I think these forbidden relationships are sort of like one of the, you know, central ways that power has been exchanged throughout time from God knows how long, you know? And being a person who is Bangladeshi, Muslim, and also a hidden secret lover to a Brahmin upper caste Indian man, I just felt like, what choice do I have but to address you and to speak to you, to show you that this story and this dance has happened before. It just felt like it made perfect sense. And it came from a place that really just, I have not read before. That doesn't mean it isn't there, but I think so much of the record that we have are these men establishing what is, you know, the story, and to speak to them or him as my story felt like a way of, you know, subverting that narrative. And
I thought that was very, there were two things I thought were cleverly done with that whole thing. One was where you said, I mean, you made it your own story. You took that power back. The second was how you used that as a jumping off point to then get into this whole ancient history of the other woman, right? To say, like you said, to say, you know what, this dance isn't new. It's been done before. And, you know, you know, I'm taking, and all those women, they may not have, their voices may have been silenced, but I'm taking my story back. So I thought that was great. That's why I thought, you know, it's important to bring that up. I think it shows a different way. Like you said, I don't think I've necessarily seen that yet in a memoir by a Thesey writer. So I thought that was great.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think part of that is also just showing the difference between my embodiment and this person's embodiment, mm-hmm. and this, you know, way that, you know, we understand Thesey identity. You know, it's like, if we're talking about Desh and actual land in South Asia, the three main nation states that are engaged in this concept of Desh would be India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, even though I know people, I actually think I witnessed that exchange when you were talking about the word Desi, and how people took issue with it if they were, you know, from Bangladesh or Sri Lanka. I don't know. There was just like some sort of debate on if this term is useful. Of course, I came up, I grew up in the 90s when that term started to sort of proliferate my consciousness. So I totally felt connected to it because, yeah, my friends were Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi. They were representing the swaths of cultures that, you know, we all belong to. But I thought that it was a way for me to assert difference in how I experience and inhabit the world from an upper caste Indian man. You know, like, we just do not have, even though my sensuality and love and power is something that is feeding this person in some way, what does that mean when you're walking hand in hand in the world, in the light? You know, we aren't able to do that. We will never be able to do that. And yeah, there's always a power. Sadness there, you know, there's like a metaphor there where I'm like, our land is divided, and that is very deeply sad. I don't think it's natural. I think it's a crime, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, the borders are all man-made. I'm thinking of last year, there was a book by Suchitra Vijayan where she actually went around all the borderlands, right? She traveled all around 7,000 miles or something. And some of those stories she shared are pretty harrowing. And you've mentioned some of them from the wartime, you know, in your own book. So I think, I think the more we can bring those to people's consciousness, I mean, they're there, but they're buried, you know, and so they need to come forward so we understand them better. So let me
I love her work, and I love the Polis Project, and those are the things I miss about Twitter, to be honest.
Well, she's on Instagram too now, so
that's yes of course.
But Twitter is a different place, but we could get into there, but never mind. I do have two more questions. These are my usual that I ask everyone, and one is, you know, what's next, if you can talk about it, what's next for you, both in terms of your book and the business, if you could share a little bit, give us a little snippet of what might be coming.
Yes, of course. I'm excited to say that I have a conversation with my friend who is a Bengali Indian American woman, Samita Mukhopadhyay, at the Brooklyn Museum. And that should be an incredible conversation. So it's on March 10th at the Brooklyn Museum. And if folks are in New York City, I would love for them to come to that. And it will be, I think, live streamed, but it will be available on YouTube as well. So that's something I'm looking forward to, because I think we have such a beautiful way of talking about feminism and the dynamics of caste, the history that we share as Bengali women from East and West Bengal, which is very, very profound for me. It's been very healing, our friendship. So I think that will be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And then I have another event virtually with Kiese Lehman on March 17th through Skylight Books and the Institute for Art and Old Faction. So those are two events I'm looking very forward to. And Kiese is the first writer who made me believe I could be a writer as a young student at Vassar College when he was teaching. So we've just known each other from, you know, as kids, you know, it's just really, really special. I only want to have conversations about this work with people who can really hold it with care. I don't want to participate in conversations where I have to prove myself to, you know, dominance. I just don't. So that's part of why these convos are so special, and talking to you has been wonderful as well. As for the brand, you know, I've spent the last year rebranding as Tanais, and Tanais obviously is Tanmi Nandini Islam, the first two letters of my name. And it's sort of like, again, like fucking with this idea of like, oh, we all have to be brands now, which I understand how there's a deep repulsion at this idea, right? But for me, it's something that I own. It's mine. It's my space. It's my imagination. And no one can take that from me. So these candles and perfumes that have been released as Tanais that are new are sort of imagined alongside Incensorium. And some of the things that I'm doing in these readings is sharing those fragrances. Like for my event at the Strand, people smelled this perfume called Mati. And this idea of Mati is very central to the heart notes of the book, because Mati is the earth, the ground, the dirt. Mati is the terracotta bricks that the pregnant women in my mom's village would eat when they had cravings for connection. And we know that people, you know, ingest things to have some emotional need, you know, addressed, but also maybe a want for minerals and nutrients that are found in the dirt. So this perfume is one of the new ones that I'm really excited about. And it just has notes that come from South Asia, you know, so it has Mitti Atar from the Ganges River, clay steeped in sandalwood from Kanauj, the capital of perfume in India. It has notes of Bandarban sandalwood from the hill tracks in Bangladesh, rose, jasmine, beetle leaf, like the pan that our grandmothers and I sometimes like to chew. You know, there's a lot of things that are in this work that, you know, the word reclamation has come up for me when I've talked to people, but part of it is really honoring the materials and landscapes and scents, obviously the flavors, all those things in a way that's just for us, you know, that doesn't need to be translated to people who want to call that orientalizing ourselves or selling ourselves. It's like, yes, I am selling an object to be sold. Yes. But that is different from capitalism. This is about commerce, about sharing and trading and exchanging ideas and resources, hopefully so that people can feel something.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And, you know, one thing that I wanted to mention to you just as before I forget is when I teach, I you know, I also to earn my living so I can write more freely, I teach. And when I teach, one of the books I recommend to students is Diane Ackerman's A Natural History of the Senses.
Oh, yes, of course.
I like that. And that's been up till now. But I'm going to be starting to recommend your book now, because I think what I like about yours is, you know, you are doing all of that, which she had done, which is bringing in the senses and bringing in the history of it. But you've done so much more, because you've woven in, you know, history and your personal story, and it just shows how you can do that. And I think it's a great, I hope the book gets taught, is what I'm saying, because I think it's a great tool for other writers to see how you can bring in all the senses and bring in all this history and just layer in all these textures. So I think that's, it's a great thing.
Thank you. That's
great in terms of what, you know, the book, what you've got. And Samhita's great. She used to be, wasn't she an editor at Vogue or somewhere, Teen Vogue?
She was the executive editor at Teen Vogue. She's one of the founders of Feministing, which is so iconic.
Yeah, she is. And I think she's got a memoir at some point. I know I saw something.
She has a book coming out too. Yes. Yeah. Within the next year, I think. So it's just such an honor to talk to her. And I think As we, you and I have talked about this in our respective kind of musings, is mm-hmm. just the work that you put in and feeling like, you know, are people seeing what came before them? Are they honoring mm-hmm. the legacies? I think mm-hmm. she's a huge part of the feminist internet legacy. And I think right. I'm just ready to, you know, just document that yes. and honor that. And that's something very exciting for me. And I'm just very indebted to, you know, the people who have shown the greatest support for this work are people mm-hmm. from my past lives, obviously, you know, former fellow students at Brooklyn College MFA, and then just like they see women and femmes mm. who are just really aligned with the project of this book because they have their own experiences
yeah.
within these industries. And I feel that from you, I feel that with Samita. So it's just mm. it's very special to lift each other up and to be in conversation with each other. I think that's something we need to do more and more.
We need to do more. Yeah, I totally agree. So, my last question, which you've mentioned obviously a lot of literary foremothers in the book. However, to put you on the spot, if you had to pick a favorite book by a Desi writer, what would it be and why? Could be a recent one, doesn't have to be favorite of all time.
Yeah, no, I'm just thinking because I feel like there's so many.
Yeah. I try to get one recommendation because then I try to, you know, make sure that our readers then or listeners then go and pick that up. So that's kind of why I asked the question.
Absolutely. I would say, you know, and this is in my book, but for people who don't know a lot about the context of Bangladesh's history and birth, which is something that I obviously talk about in this book, mm-hmm. I would say please read Tarfia Faizullah's Seam,
yes.
The collection of poems based on interviews with survivors of wartime rape mm-hmm. who are known as the Birangona. And mm-hmm. it's just like a sweep of so much profound pain and also love and honoring these women.
Yeah.
And I would say that book for me, I returned to that book for this work and mm-hmm. just had so much gratitude when that book was written because it opened a new portal into my own people. So I would love for people to mm-hmm. kind of visit that book if they have not yet done that.
Yeah, I actually found out about it, I don't know, 2014 or 15. And she's in Dallas now. I need to meet her now that everything is opened up. I need to arrange to meet with
right,
her.
Right, that's where you are. Correct.
Yeah, she's here. But yeah, that is a terrific collection. And what a project, what a necessary and important project, you know, for her to have done.
Yes, and I also would love to shout out another book, if mm-hmm. I may.
Sure.
I loved Coming Out as Dalit. Yeah, by Yashika Dutt. I felt so moved by this whole process of what it means to decolonize and not pass anymore as something that's palatable or safe, and the bravery that it takes to do that. So yes, Yashika Dutt, another writer that I admire and really love.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Coming Out as Dalit. Yeah. That's a very important book. And
very important book. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Those are great recommendations. And mm-hmm. thank you for this gift of a book. I'm so glad you wrote it. And I'm so glad that we were able to talk about it. And you're all recovered and you're getting to celebrate the book in person with good friends. And that's
yes. Absolutely. Thank you for this. It's such a gift to talk to you. And just, I love what you're doing with Desi Books. It's so important for us to have this archive, honestly. It's
That's how I see it too. It's an archive. I just mm-hmm. wanted to look at this multitude of voices, you know? We're not mm-hmm. all just the two books that you see in the New York Times, you know?
Right.
So, yeah.
Exactly. Thank you so much,
Jenny.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to episode 69 of Desi Books, news and views about Desi literature from the world over. I'm your host, Jenny Bart. Thank you for tuning in. Today's Desi Craft Chat was with Tanias discussing their new memoir, In Sensorium. Episode 70 will be up shortly. Follow on Twitter at Desi Books, Instagram at Desi.books, Facebook at Desi Books FB. Tag the accounts if you have requests or suggestions. And please go to the website if you'd like to sign up for the free weekly newsletter. That's DeciBooks.co. And please share this interview via social media so we can keep raising the tide of Desi literature. Stay healthy, keep reading, and write well.